So, I'm going to compact the first 22 years of my life in this first section and sort of start where I was at when I was 22. The things that you need to know, I'd love to share with you, are that I come from a lovely family. I have a mum and dad who are still together, and I'm amazingly grateful for that. I have an older sister and two younger brothers. We all live locally now, so this is truly home for us. And I became a Christian when I was 13 during a confirmation course, funnily enough. So that was an amazing experience, but I was in a church that didn't know very much about the Holy Spirit, so I didn't kind of grow up in my early faith knowing very much about the Holy Spirit. But by the time I had got to the age of 22, I was completely convinced that I was worthless. And I know that there are a lot of people who feel that way today. If you read the statistics about our young people, it is frightening how many of them suffer feeling the same way. But it's not just young people who can feel that they are totally insignificant and totally unworthy. There'll be people sitting here this morning who will know those feelings themselves. So how did I, as a Christian from a loving family, get to that point? Let me share that with you. I had an amazing time at primary school. Primary school was fab. Secondary school was another story. I started school with lots of friends, and by the third year, a new girl had come to school. I'd been given the job of showing her around, and within weeks, she'd moved into my friendship group and effectively kicked me out. And I was friendless for the first time in my whole life, and I didn't quite know what to do. I don't suppose I handled it very well. I look back and I remember just feeling so ashamed of myself. And the thing that I couldn't bear to happen was for a teacher to walk into a classroom and see me sitting on my own. So when it came to break times, I would get up, I would go outside, and I would walk as fast as I could around the school to make it look as though I was on my way to meet somebody so that nobody would ever know. And I didn't tell my mum and dad, and I don't know why I didn't, but I didn't. And that was bewildering. That was a bewildering time. And while that was happening at school, things between my sister and myself started to kind of go a bit odd at home. We had played so happily together as little girls. There's a year and a half between us. She'd been my best playmate. And then suddenly she just wasn't interested in me anymore either. And I couldn't quite understand that our lives were kind of going in different directions. I'd been on this confirmation course, I'd become a Christian, I was getting involved in church. I also played in a brass band, not up there as the coolest thing you can do when you're a teenager, but I loved it anyway. And she was into clubbing and boyfriends and getting drunk. And it turned out that she was being really badly bullied at school, and she didn't tell us either. So we were both kind of living these secret lives alongside each other. And I felt really hurt by the fact that she just was pushing us all away. And I could see what she was doing to mum and dad, and that hurt me as well. And while this was all going on, we also had a cousin who lived very close to us. He was older than us, but he was like a bigger brother. And he would come around two or three times a week, and we'd have tea together, we'd play games, and then Saturday night kind of became movie night. And he introduced us to horror movies. And I hate horror movies, always have done. My sister loved them. And I kind of said, actually, no, I don't really like these horror movies. Can we watch something else? No. Every week another horror movie would come in. He would come round to our house when the video, can you remember videos? The video van used to be outside. And they would buy horror movies together. And so I was excluded from my relationship with my sister and my cousin. He was like a bigger brother. And that was really difficult to take. And it kind of felt as though my opinion didn't matter to them. And so I'd lost friends, I'd lost a sister, and I'd lost a cousin. And that pattern of feeling ignored continued into college. I did make new friends, which was great. But when it came to the weekends, we'd have a conversation that sort of went, what should we do this weekend? And I'd go, oh, shall we maybe kind of watch a film, not a horror movie? Should we maybe have a sleepover? Could we go to the pub and shoot some pool? And, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't we do that next week? Let's go clubbing this week. So we'd go clubbing, and I hated clubbing. I always have, and I always will. I'm just not a clubber. But the next weekend would come, and it would be great. Should we watch a movie this week? Now, do you know what? We'll go clubbing this week. We'll do the movie next week. And so it went on, week after week after week. We never once watched a movie. We never once had a sleepover. We never once went to the pub to shoot some pool. But every week, they went clubbing, and eventually, I just stopped going. And nobody said anything, and nobody said, oh, actually, Sarah's not with us anymore. Why don't we watch a film? Nobody said that. So to me, that meant that they hadn't noticed, and that they didn't care. And so I kind of started to think that what I wanted wasn't that important, and maybe actually I wasn't the sort of person that people could make friends with, so maybe I wasn't very nice. And I started to learn this game that if I did what other people wanted me to do, then they would be my friends. But if I was myself, then they wouldn't be. So by the time I hit university, I was playing a really exhausting game. Every time I met somebody new, my brain would be thinking, right, what do they like? What don't they like? What do they want me to be like? What kind of friendship do they want? And I would be trying to deliver all of the time, almost being like a mirror to them. And I was becoming more and more invisible. My self-worth, which is a very commonly used expression, but my self-worth was really fragile. And then, add into all of this, my cousin, who had watched the horror movies, who had been a big part of our life, completely and out of the blue, sat down on the 3rd of January, 1996, took a whole load of pills and killed himself. It was an absolute shock. It was a total rejection of us as a family, of me, even more of a rejection. And we were in shock. It was a Friday, and I had to head back to university on the Sunday. I'm not even quite sure how we managed to pack the suitcases that weekend. But we got back, and I didn't speak for about a week. I just went into shutdown. There was no words. There was nothing. But I'd been part of a prayer group that had met every Friday afternoon. So I went to this prayer group this week. And there was only one other girl there at the time, because it was still the start of term and people, and it was a miserable day. I remember being really cold and really rainy. And it was a friend that I'd actually prayed with a lot. She'd been through a really difficult time with different things. I'd sat with her, I'd listened to her, I'd prayed with her. And we sat in her bedroom, and I just suddenly found myself crying. And I told her about Philip, that was my cousin's name. And I told her what had happened. And I'm not quite sure what I expected to happen next, but I didn't expect her to get up and walk out of the door and leave me sitting on her bedroom floor. But that's what she did. And I thought, maybe she's gone for some tissues, or maybe she needed to go to the toilet. She's got to come back because it's her bedroom. But she didn't come back. She just left me sitting there. So I dried my eyes, blew my nose, I got up, and when I left her house, I knew for sure, deep down in my heart, that if I wasn't to be offered kindness in a moment such as that, then I truly was worth nothing at all. And those people who had rejected me in the past had been completely and utterly right to do so. So that's how I got to that point. And then I went to work for a church, St. George's Church in Stamford. Some of you would have met Kim and Penelope. Kim was my first boss. When I arrived, I still have no idea why they employed me. I was a wreck. Emotionally and spiritually, I was just a mess. And I was frightened. I spent the first 3 or 4 months there thinking, when they realise what I'm really like, I'm going to get a phone call from Kim, and he's going to say, actually, Sarah, do you know, we can't keep employing you, you need to go home. And I was really frightened that was going to happen. I was really scared of being found out. And it got to the point, and this is really silly, but I felt so bad about myself that there were clothes shops and cafes that I would not go into, because I honestly did, that they would ask me to leave their premises because I would put other people off going into the shop. It was a real prison that I had been living in. But there is a happy ending, or more of a happy beginning, so let me tell you about that part. We had a worship workshop at the church, and I went along for the day. And I was expecting sheets of music and a big kind of bash and all of that. But we got there and the guy said, no, sheets of music down. We're just going to play in the spirit. I had no idea what that meant. Completely freaked me out, if I'm honest. So I had my euphonium that some of you have seen. I played at the Christmas fair a couple of weeks ago. I put my euphonium down and I refused to play. And the other people, I'm like, I can't do it. I'm not doing that. Don't be ridiculous. So I got really cross. But then other people had come along, and so the idea was that those with instruments would just wander around the church and just play what they felt the Lord wanted them to play. And the others of us would sit down and allow ourselves to be played over. All a bit strange. And my mind went into this game-playing mode that I go into, and I thought, you know, no one will want to play over me. And it'll be really embarrassing if everybody here notices that I'm the only one that nobody plays over. So I'm going to go and sit in the furthest corner of the church, And that will be the reason why it will look as though nobody's come to play with me. So I won't be embarrassed and they won't be embarrassed and all will be well. So off I go to the furthest corner of the church, sit there, wait for it to pass over and everything will be fine. But then a guy who played a flute wandered over to the furthest corner in that church and he played over me. Not really sure what he played, but as he played, I heard a voice as clear as I have heard any voice in my whole life. And the voice simply said, "What are you doing, Sarah? Don't you know that I love you?" And I can't really describe what happened to me in that moment. I cried for 48 hours non-stop after that moment. There was a lot of pain that had to come out. But in an instant, excuse me, the prison that had been built up around this little heart of mine was just taken away. God's love came in and took it away. There was no scary big deal. It was the gentlest, most loving moment of my life. And he reached down into the mess and the muddle that I was in, and he set me free. And it took months and months to discover the fullness of what that would mean for me. But everything changed physically. I cut my hair shorter, I got smaller glasses, my face came back out again because I'd been hiding away. I was wearing clothes that were two or three sizes too big. I suddenly started to wear the right clothes. I smiled, I laughed, I let people hug me, I let children sit on my lap, this close to my face that I once thought was so ugly, and I let them touch my face and smile. And I had a freedom. I spoke my opinion. And when other people's opinions didn't match mine, I didn't take it personally. Everything had been so painfully personal before then. Everything changed. I felt 10 stone lighter. It was incredible. And you know, our God isn't afraid of mess. He comes right into the middle of mess. He was born in a stable, in a manger, to a couple who had become effectively social outcasts. Mary by law should have been stoned, she should have been dead, so should have Jesus been. And Joseph, by committing to her, would have lost social standing. And think of the business he would have lost because of that. They were in a fragile, messy situation. And I know it's a bit cliche, and you've probably heard it said before, but Jesus wasn't born into a palace. He wasn't given servants to wait on him. He was born into mess and muddle and need. And God said that was perfect. That was the perfect way to come into this world. And I love what the angels said at the end of our first reading. "This is how you will recognize him. You will find a baby in a manger." Yes. How do we recognize God? By his splendor, by his glory, by his perfection. Sometimes yes, but no, we recognize him by where we find him, and we find him in the manger. So we're going to have some worship in a moment, but just as we go into that, just a chance for you to think and maybe reflect, I wonder whether you are someone whose life journey is pushing you into hiding. I wonder whether you are somebody who is living with feelings of just worthlessness. So often, it's not things we do ourselves, it's things that happen around us and are done to us. Are there messes and muddles in your life? Are there messes and muddles in your hearts, your souls, your families, your friendships, your work? Do you just need to honestly bring that out before the Lord of the manger this morning? So let's take some time to worship. If you need someone to pray with you, just turn to a neighbour, or there might be somebody here who's sort of been walking through some of these things with you. Just go and grab them. If not, stand, sit, move around, but let's just worship the Lord together. All the time, even when we don't feel it, he is. I'm going to fast forward now to another part of my journey. So it was a time when our Toby was born. 10 days before he was born, our midwife sent us to the hospital because she thought something wasn't quite right. And basically, he was extended breech, so he was the wrong way round. It was extended reach, but also he was really big. He was showing he's going to be bigger than 10 pounds. So I was booked in for a cesarean section. And I have to tell you that I was actually terrified. I don't know why, and I don't know where that came from, but when we'd done our little tour of the unit, we'd ended up in the theatre, and they said certain percentage of first-time mums end up in theatre. And something just inside me went, that's going to be you. And I thought, no, I don't want that. I don't want that. But it was the only way he was going to come out. As Adrian says it now, flippantly, as a man can, he came out the sunroof. Only a man can say that with a smile on his face. But anyway, I lay in the operating theatre waiting for the epidural to go in. Nothing against consultants, but the consultant came and tried for about 15 minutes. He'd gone in every vein that I had. I was getting more and more frightened. He didn't seem to be registering that at all until finally a lovely nurse just said, shall I do that, doctor? And off he went, straight in first time. But waiting for the epidural to kick in was awful. I've never had a sensation like that. Going numb. You can't feel. And nobody had told me that you wouldn't be able to feel yourself breathe. But I couldn't. It came right up to here, numbness. I couldn't feel myself breathe, and I started to panic. So I'm lying there, and they also had this arrangement where you had to lie cruciform. So your arms were out like this on this board. Stuff up everywhere. You don't even think about what's going on down the other end. But you're lying there, and I couldn't breathe, and I was panicking. And poor Adrian, bless him. He was so good. But I thought I was going to die. I thought that was it. I'd never had an operation before. I knew what they were doing. I knew it could go wrong, and I thought I was going to die. And then something did go wrong, nothing major. Apparently there were people charging around everywhere. But it all went well. Mother and baby were fine, sent home after 5 days. But were they fine? I actually wasn't. Fear had gotten in. Fear is an awful thing, and fear can get in. And actually, in my experience, the only thing that can deal with fear is Jesus. No pill, no counselling, just Jesus. But fear had gotten in. And because Toby was 10 pounds 3 in the end, the midwife said to me, you mustn't lift him for 6 weeks. He's too heavy. He's heavier than a kettle. You mustn't lift him for 6 weeks. So I had to watch as Adrian had the joy of giving him his first bath, changing his nappies, choosing his clothes, getting him dressed, playing with him. And I'm watching Adrian's confidence grow as mine just disappears. And then the day came when Adrian had to go back to college and I was left with Toby on my own. And the fear and the lack of confidence crashed in around me like the biggest wave. And I spiraled really quickly into postnatal depression. And if I'm honest, I think it started the 10 days before when I found out I was going to have the C-section. And do you know, it was horrid. There were a number of ways that it kind of came out in me. I know it's different for different people, but I actually just stopped sleeping completely. I don't mean that I had half an hour one night, 2 hours the next night. I stopped completely. I didn't know that you could survive on no sleep, but I did. And it was awful. I would give Toby his nighttime feed, then I would lay awake, waiting for him to wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, give him the next feed, and then I would lay awake, waiting for him to wake up at 6 o'clock, give him that feed. And all the time I was awake, and I would be lying there, night after night, hour after hour, listening to Adrian snoring, because he does, listening to Toby making all the little snuffling noises that babies make, thinking, they're sleeping? Why am I not sleeping? And then I would start crying. 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I would hit the wall. I would turn over and hit the wall. I would be screaming inside, desperately thinking, how can I get through tomorrow if I haven't had a sleep tonight? And I didn't sleep last night, and I didn't sleep the night before. And then that all accumulated, and I became clumsy, and I became forgetful, and I actually couldn't put words together because my brain was just this mush of no sleep. I didn't feel I could drive anywhere. I hardly felt safe to cross the road, which is a bit silly, but I just was so exhausted. And it was just a very strange time. And then the afternoons, please don't think that I'm crazy when I say this, but I'm just going to tell you what it was like in the afternoons. And I don't know why it was the afternoons. Between 3 and 5 o'clock, I have no idea why, I'd get these overpowering thoughts in my head. I don't know where they came from, but it was like they were just charging at me. Thoughts that would kind of go, this is never going to get better. You're going to be like this for the rest of your life. There's no hope for you. It's only going to get worse. You're not going to make it through another day, not a single day. You're never going to cope. Look at you. You've totally fallen apart. And I would sort of just be sitting. All I could do was sit as these thoughts came at me. It took so much energy just to try and stand against them. And then while I was standing against them, I would be dreading the ones that were coming next. There was absolutely no peace at all. And then when it kind of, I don't know, 5:30-ish, it would all go calm. There was actually no peace at all because I would be worrying about the next day. Would the thoughts next day be worse? And I don't know whether it's because we had a suicide in our family history, whether I was standing against that thinking, don't put me in that place, I can't be in that place. But I never got to that point. I once got to the front door thinking, I'm going to get in that car and I'm just going to go. And I don't know where I'm going and I don't know when I'm coming back. But then I had enough sense in that moment to think, but actually the problem's mine, it's here. Wherever I go, that problem comes with me. But it felt as though I was clinging on by my fingernails, and we moved from college to Tasborough in the middle of that time. So it was actually, we'd lost our support networks, everything was up in the air, we had to start again. And I had friends praying for me, and I was praying for myself. I had begged, I had pleaded, I had raged and furied at God, if I'm honest. But I had simply stopped feeling him. I had completely lost the Lord. I didn't know how to feel him, I didn't know how to know him. I was just empty of God. I don't know where he had gone. He hadn't gone anywhere, but the depression had just done something so awful in me that he had gone. He felt it, so he had gone. And it was a very long walk for us as a young family. About 10 months into the depression, we just decided to go away. And we have a good friend, some of you will have met him at Revive, a friend of ours called Trevor. And we went to stay at his house in Leeds. And we just had a week. He hired a hot tub. Wasn't that just amazing? He hired a hot tub for the garden. And so Toby slept and I sat in the hot tub for most of the week. And I did a little bit of sleeping. A little bit of sleep came back. And we went to church on the Sunday morning. And I can't remember what they spoke on, but it was something that stirred me up and made me think I need to go for prayer. So I went to the front, and I don't often go forward for prayer. And I stood in front of this lady and I said, "Hi, I'm Sarah. I've got a little baby boy and it's been really difficult. Can you please pray for me?" And this is the prayer that she prayed. "Sarah, you do not have to fear for your future because of your past. Just because things are this way now, it doesn't mean this is how they always will be. You have a God of hope." The power of hope. I could almost go, the power of love, but I won't sing that song. The power of hope. I had lost sight of it. I hadn't deliberately done that. It had just happened. It had been drowned out by my depression, and it had been shrunken up by the fear. But the power of hope. It shifted something in me, and I was no longer frightened. And I remember sitting in the car on the way home thinking, what are we going home to? Is it just going to be another 10 months of what we've got? And then this little voice said, "Sarah, tomorrow will either be a good day or it will be a bad day. And that's okay." And I thought, "Ooh, that's a new thought. I haven't thought that one before." And so we went home. And I think the next day was awful, if I'm honest. But I went to bed the next night and I thought, tomorrow will either be a good day or it will be a bad day. And I had some good hours in that next day, and there were more good hours. And over time, those hours became good days. And then those good days became good weeks. And actually, it wasn't an instant, massive prayer answer. Do you know what I mean? I think I had been demanding my big God to give me a big answer to prayer, and that was the only answer I was going to accept, thank you very much. It wasn't that. But that prayer was the signpost out. And it showed me the way to walk forward. Thank God for the power of hope. There are lots of things that can make us lose hope, aren't there, if we're honest? And maybe some of you here feel this morning that you have. And if you have, can I just stand with you and say, I am so sorry. I know what that feels like. But there is hope. And how do we know there is hope? Because Jesus came as the light into the darkness. And can I tell you something else that I think is amazing? The darkness can never, ever, ever put that light out. Know it. Please know it. With every fibre in your being, know it. I had forgotten it. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, Lord, that I did. But when I was told it again, my word, it made a difference. Maybe you feel that your future is set because of your past. Maybe you feel that things will never change for you because of where you have been. No. Jesus came to rewrite our futures, to deal with our past and to rewrite the futures. And there will be some days when it is hard to live that out because we won't feel it. But thank God, hope doesn't depend on whether I feel it or not. Hope doesn't depend on me or you. There will never be, I've written this down, it's completely silly, there will never not be hope. English people among you will know that that probably doesn't work, but it felt right when I wrote it. There will always be hope because there is always God. It's very simple. And you know, we hear those words every Christmas. The light comes into the darkness and the darkness has not put it out. We hear them every year, but there is a fullness and a richness and a depth to those words that just passes us by. Jesus is the light in our darkness. He came to bring us hope. He has the power to set us free. We do not need to fear because light will always win. Always. So let us take some time to worship again, as you feel you need. Grab someone for prayer if you want to. Kneel, sit, pray, move around, and then we'll worship God, and then I'll come up for the last bit, which will be much shorter than all of these. I love that song because it says it all, doesn't it, really? Light into darkness. Thank God that you came. The last bit I want to share with you is kind of backtracking to the interview day last year. And just before we went on the interview day, I'd been to a conference in Norwich, and the speaker had talked about transition, moving from one place to another, and she'd use the imagery of butterflies and cocoons. So when we came here, there was, I can remember, there were butterflies flying around, and it was very exciting for us. So it was a really timely kind of word from the Lord for me, really, because we'd been in a state of uprooting in the Taz Valley for a while, and we'd felt unsettled and uncomfortable, and we didn't know what was going on, and we were confused. But when this lady had spoken, I went forward for prayer again. So I'm sharing with you. I've probably been up for prayer for about four times in my life, and I've shared two of them with you this morning. So when I go, it's pretty amazing. Something happens. I actually had the speaker who came to pray with me, just how it worked out, and she put her hands on my shoulders. And she just said, I see you wearing a jacket which has become too tight for you. The Lord has a new jacket for you to wear. This jacket is a bigger one, and it might feel a bit too big to start with, but it is the right jacket for you, and the Lord will help you grow into it. So when we came to the interview day, I was wearing my butterfly dress. I came, and I had one question in my heart. Is this the place where we can fly as a family? Will we fly in this place? I don't know why that was the question, but it just sort of came out of the conference. And when we came into the back of church, and we met the other candidates, and I thought, oh, they were just brilliant. They were a brilliant bunch of people. And I thought, that one is so confident. And look at that one. They're asking all the right questions. That one's being really courteous and holding the door open for everybody. And my head went down and I thought, no, this isn't ours to have. So when we went to look around the house, I didn't pay any attention because I thought, if it's not going to be my home, I don't want to be teased by the thought that it could be. So actually, when we found out we had the job, I couldn't tell you a thing about the house because I just ignored it all the time we'd been walking around. But as the day went on, and we met people and we chatted to people and we went around the group, I thought, do you know, these people talk church the way that we talk church, and they think church the way that we think church, and they're wrestling with the same sort of questions about church that we're wrestling with. And I want to do this adventure called church with them. Actually, no, Lord, I want to do this adventure called life with these people. And we were heading off on holiday that day, so we'd postponed going, so we only went to the deepest, darkest depths of Lincolnshire, so we weren't going far, but we were driving off at about 7 o'clock at night, waiting for the bishop to phone, and He said he would phone after half past seven. And we didn't get the phone call until about 9:15. So we were convinced we hadn't got it. He must have phoned the other person first to say yes and then was coming round doing all the no's. But when we're in the car, I remember saying to Adrian, I just want to hold these people in my heart. I feel as though they're there already, Lord. I just want to carry them in my prayers. And I know to some of you, I'm old enough to be your mother. And to some of you, I'm young enough to be your daughter. And to others of you, I could be your sister or an aunt. And I actually haven't been a vicar's wife properly before at all. And I don't actually have a clue what I'm doing. But this is the jacket that the Lord has given me to wear. And I'm so honoured to wear it. And I know that you've been in my heart since that interview day. And I can't get rid of you at the moment. So I'm sorry, that's just kind of how it is. And I carry you with me in my prayers. But part of the jacket being too big for me, and this is just kind of what I want to share to finish, is that we have a youngish family, so there are certain priorities of life for us at the moment. And we have ongoing health issues with Toby. And when they flare up, it's unpredictable. There's no warning. But when they flare up, he can be housebound for weeks at a time. And if he's housebound, then I'm housebound too. And so it means that while I might notice things, I can't always do something about the things that I notice. But can I tell you that if I have noticed, I am praying. Because I can do that, and I can do that whether I'm in the home or whether I'm out and about. And even though I'm standing up here now, actually I'm quite a shy person. Conversationally, I'm quite shy. I'm a bit of an odd mixture, really. But I really worry about saying the wrong thing. I really do worry about saying the wrong thing, saying it the wrong thing at the wrong time, and creating awkward situations for people. And I'm getting to know you. And I'm really liking getting to know you. You're a great bunch. Thank you for being great. But I don't know your stories yet. There is so much. You and I've stood up here and shared mine this morning, but there's so much to know about you all. And so while I might notice that you're going through a difficult patch, I find myself sort of thinking, but you've probably got a network of people here already who've kind of walked through this with you, and they're better able to speak into it than I am. So I don't pick up the phone. I've written so many emails and then deleted them because I've just thought, no, I can't. What will they think if I do that? And then while I might notice that you're flat out busy all of the time, and for me, that would just be awful because I can't do flat out busy all the time, I find myself thinking, but I don't actually know you well enough to know whether you thrive on busyness. You might love it. You might really enjoy the way things are. So I don't know whether I can come over and say, hey, just noticed, looking a bit tired, life's a bit full on, is everything okay? So again, I don't come over and speak. And that's part of the bigger jacket thing for me here. I've got to learn to grow in my confidence, to speak out. And if I get it wrong, just give me a nice smile and say, chill out, Sarah, it's fine, and that will be okay. But the Lord has brought me here to teach me certain lessons, and there are things that I am meant to be learning from amongst you. So please, can you bear with me? If you think I haven't noticed, chances are that I have, but I've just not been able to do something, or I've bottled it and not done what I thought I should have done. And if I have spoken and it's come across as clumsy or it's felt misplaced, then please forgive me. But I'm just trying to work out how to do this thing called vicar's wife, and I don't really know. But I do know that this is the jacket that I've been given to wear. I am truly blessed and honoured to be wearing it. But please, if you notice that it needs a stitch or two or a button sewing on or fixing up, just come and tell me. And we can work at it together. So Vivian is going to come and say some prayers with us, and then we'll have another time of worship. If anything has stirred in your hearts this morning and you've just thought, you know, yeah, I'm there, I felt that, and it's coming to the surface, please do not push it down. Do not push it down. I'm not sure whether we have anybody on prayer ministry today, but great. We can have a couple of people just at the back. Yeah, there'll be some people at the back. Just go and have some prayer. Do not waste this moment. Let light be brought into your darkness. Let there be hope brought where it's needed. And I'm very oddly going to leg it over to Harvest House because Adrian wants to come back. So I'll stay for a song and then I'll go and get in. I'm not running away. So Vivian, thank you.